This BBC podcast is supported by ads outside the UK.
Egal, ob Sie gerade erst beginnen oder Ihr Sicherheitsprogramm erweitern, herausragende Sicherheitspraktiken zu demonstrieren und Vertrauen aufzubauen, ist wichtiger denn je. Vanta automatisiert die Einhaltung von ISO 27001, SOC 2 und mehr, spart Ihnen Zeit und Geld und hilft Ihnen, das Vertrauen Ihrer Kunden zu stärken. Darüber hinaus können Sie Sicherheitsüberprüfungen vereinfachen, indem Sie Fragebögen automatisieren und die Sicherheit Ihrer IT-Infrastruktur mit einem kundenorientierten Trust Center demonstrieren. Über 9000 globale Unternehmen wie Atlassian, FloHealth und Koora nutzen Vanta bereits, um Risiken zu managen und Sicherheit in Echtzeit nachzuweisen. Erhalten Sie ein spezielles Angebot von $1000 Rabatt unter vanta.com/horen.
Welcome to Science in Action from the BBC World Service with me, Roland Pease, where scientists getting ahead of the game is a bit of a theme this week. Later in the edition, the 50th anniversary of a joint attempt by biologists to anticipate and regulate for us all the then novel ideas of genetic engineering.
It meant that you could basically move DNA from any organism into any other, and that set off terrible alarm bells amongst the scientific community.
Deemed a success then, 50 years on, the assessment of Asilomar, as it's known in shorthand, is more nuanced. More on that later. We start with a call by 32 of Europe's top virologists for the continent to establish a permanent flu surveillance network, which surprised me because I assumed one existed already. But it seems that much of the scientific work tracking new strains of the virus is done via ad hoc grants, with ironic timing, given the uncertain future of some US federal health agencies. They cite America's long-standing Centers of Excellence for Influenza Research and Response as a model of how to keep ahead of potential epidemics. The researchers also have an eye on the continued spread of the worrying H5N1 strain across farms and wildlife in the US, which we've been following for a year here on Science in Action. Marion Copemans was on the programme recently describing how a European collaboration designed the PCR test for the world for COVID in the first days of the pandemic. And she's one of the signatories on the new call.
So it's not so much the surveillance that is in place, but it's what you do to prepare for novel viruses, novel variants, and there's a whole cascade of things that are needed there. And that's the model that the US has with their SEERS network. So, for instance, think about the H5 situation currently in the US, where we see transmission of this virus among cattle. We've seen that happening with not one, but now three separate introductions. That means you immediately want to know, are those viruses somehow different? Why is this happening? What does that mean? What does that mean for our stockpiles? What does that mean for possible vaccination? And that requires a certain set of expertise, expert labs that actually can look at that if and when it's needed.
So this would be staffed by experts. This wouldn't just be a distributed thing of people like you across the continent.
It would be distributed, but with expert labs. So what you have in place, which in US now is struggling, but in Europe certainly is in place, is routine influenza surveillance. So that system works pretty well. And that is, for instance, in our country and in the UK, it has a set of GP practices that sample patients, that send their samples to be tested. And if they are flu positive, then they are characterized. And that information is used and aggregated globally to understand the diversity of seasonal flu viruses and what that means for vaccine composition, for instance. But that's the routine surveillance. That's what is picking up what is essentially what we already know. That system is not so good for picking up rapid changes, you know, a surprise, an H5 introduction. For that, you really need more focused work, but also you need to have what we call a pipeline of labs ready to then characterize whatever you find. And that process is there, but it's not really formalized. So, for instance, European CDC has the routine labs reporting data to their system. That's TESI. That's the European Surveillance System. We have a WHO collaborating center that collects somewhat different seasonal viruses, and they are sent there, and they also provide reagents to the routine labs. And then there is some work on virus characterization that gets done and gets paid, but it's really only for the routine public health work, not the sort of the add-on enhanced research preparedness that you would also want to see.
It's trying to keep ahead of the virus much more than at the moment. I mean, for example, that presumably, particularly with this H5 strain of flu, requires a lot of collaboration between veterinary scientists, so people working with cattle and birds, chickens and so on, also wildlife services, because some of these strains are just so widespread outside the human population, as well as maybe aggressive surveillance of going out and trying to see who might have it amongst people.
Yeah, exactly. But also agreements in place so that you can actually share and ideally share without political interference, because that's currently a handicap. Well, less so in Europe, but that's what we currently see happening in the US. So you would want to have a system in place. Okay, if anyone picks up something like that, it can be shared rapidly among labs. So those things are occasionally in place, but that's a project with one group, then the next group, then the third group. So you don't really build long-term that collaborative capacity that you would ideally have in place.
I'm curious about the timescale for a response that you would want to see. You know, with the COVID, when that broke out, handfuls of cases in China at the very beginning of January. By mid-March, it was essentially everywhere. There are thousands of cases everywhere. Do you think that that kind of rapid spread is a kind of pattern you'd expect to be tackling with a flu pandemic?
So that's the high-hanging fruit, because that's the most difficult one, the ones that immediately spread like wildfire. But we discussed before that Europe had, for instance, pre-existing collaborative networks that jumped at the diagnostics for the SARS-CoV-2 and really were, mid-January already had the first protocols in place. So that's the kind of thing that can be done. That network by now has stopped. So we are waiting to see if something comes up to replace it. But that's exactly my point. So we have seen good examples of how having networked expert labs really prepares you for a situation like this. But that is depending on repeated competitive funding. And this paper is really a call for Europe to say, okay, that is fine and Europe has expertise, but can we look at the model that the US has developed where, yes, there is evaluation of those collaborations, but the funding is much more longer term, provided you do function and you do deliver, rather than jumping from left and right with the next call, where you also have to wait and see whether that topic is still popular in the next round of funding.
A lot of the conversation we've had in the past year, particularly with experts in America, is in fact that, in a sense, the national response has been quite slow, that the CDC and the Centers for Disease Control and so on aren't actually releasing and collating data fast enough. I guess that they could be doing it better as well.
Oh, definitely. So the US has had a good system. They have the handicap that, so you have the central CDC, which is responsible for the surveillance. which has very little to say in when it comes to veterinary circulation, animal disease, and which does not have the power to move into a state unless the state invites them in. So they have to rely on willingness at the state level to do this. So that system works quite okay for the human seasonal flu, but with the H5 situation, well, states just were not enthusiastic of calling the public health arm in.
While we're on that, I mean, there's two things I'd like to check. One is you mentioned that there are now additional routes by which cattle have been infected. So there, explain what that is and why that's concerning.
So until around about a month ago, all the viruses that have been spreading in cattle were from one introduction with a specific genetic lineage of H1.
So it probably came from a bird at some point and then it went from cattle to cattle.
Exactly. So there you could think, okay, that has been probably some kind of freak accident. I don't know, a bird grinded into some cow food, or we don't know how exactly, but that happened. But roughly a month ago, a new strain was detected in cattle in Nevada, and that was a new genotype. And just very recently, that same genotype has been found in a totally unrelated situation in cattle in Arizona. So now we are looking at three introductions, which changes how you think about it. So like, it's apparently not that rare. We don't know what happens and why these viruses then are introduced, but it does raise the question also, are we going to see this in Europe?
Well, I was wondering that. These viruses are being moved around by mostly wild birds, as I understand it, and these strains seem to be completely embedded in wild birds populations in the United States, in North America. At some point, migrations could be bringing those back. Well, firstly, could be bringing them back to Europe, but also be taking them presumably across to Asia as well.
Scientists do communicate. But the sort of the formal reporting systems hampered. For instance, the U.S. CDC, their weekly has been offline for a bit, which is the first time in decades. The U.S. has not shared the information that they normally provide to WHO for the global vaccine composition meeting. That's wild. So I explained that every region has this routine surveillance. All that data gets pooled and analyzed at the global level to see, okay, what does this mean for what we need to put into the vaccine recommendation for the next season? The U.S. did not provide that anymore, U.S. CDC, because it wasn't allowed to do that, because it was WHO and the U.S. doesn't like WHO. Now, this is only a short period of time, but if this would continue, then definitely the surveillance will be impacted, no doubt, because you get less information from the U.S. then for the global picture of what are we looking at and is there anything brewing that we should be thinking about, should be preparing for.
The bottom line of your commentary is that we are seeing with the continued circulation of H5N1 strains that this is potentially an extremely serious situation.
So potentially, yes. There's no indication currently that there is human-to-human transmission. But with also the recent reintroductions into cattle tells you, okay, this is not over. There is something under the radar that makes that happen, and we have no idea what that is. And I would like to have a very proactive sharing of information on this is what we're seeing, this is what we did to make sure that we understand the situation on the ground, and that's currently, and it has not been good over the past several months from the US.
Marion Koopmans of the Erasmus Medical Center in Rotterdam, alert to the potential for flu to surge unexpectedly through our populations. A reminder, you're listening to Science in Action from the BBC World Service.
Egal, ob Sie gerade erst beginnen oder Ihr Sicherheitsprogramm erweitern, herausragende Sicherheitspraktiken zu demonstrieren und Vertrauen aufzubauen, ist wichtiger denn je. Vanta automatisiert die Einhaltung von ISO 27001, SOC 2 und mehr, spart Ihnen Zeit und Geld und hilft Ihnen, das Vertrauen Ihrer Kunden zu stärken. Darüber hinaus können Sie Sicherheitsüberprüfungen vereinfachen, indem Sie Fragebögen automatisieren und die Sicherheit Ihrer IT-Infrastruktur mit einem kundenorientierten Trust Center demonstrieren. Über 9000 globale Unternehmen wie Atlassian, Flow Health und Koora nutzen Vanta bereits, um Risiken zu managen und Sicherheit in Echtzeit nachzuweisen. Erhalten Sie ein spezielles Angebot von $1000 Rabatt unter vanta.com/horen.
Mention Asilomar to most scientists, certainly to biologists, and they'll instantly recognise what you're talking about. An exercise in scientific self-restraint 50 years ago, when geneticists and molecular biologists, foreseeing the awesome power of the latest developments in DNA manipulation, chose to explore the potential and hazards before going further and to set rules for what should be allowed. It's still largely seen as a model of social responsibility in the sciences, though at a meeting at the same California campus this weekend, the spirit of Asilomar, a new generation of researchers will be re-examining that legacy. Among them, Matthew Cobb, whose History, The Genetic Age, digs deep into the issues.
The double helix had been discovered in 1953, the genetic code had been cracked in 1961, but this didn't actually really matter very much in a way, because you couldn't do very much with this information. Indeed, the first proof that DNA was a genetic material in multicellular organisms didn't come until after Asilomar. So you've got this technique, you've got this knowledge about what DNA is and how it works, but it wasn't able to be applied. That began to change at the end of the 1960s, when a series of enzymes were discovered, which were turned into tools for manipulating DNA in viruses and in bacteria. And the result of this was that scientists began to become both very excited, because this enabled them to do all sorts of clever experiments in principle to understand about how cells work, but also to become extremely alarmed that they might inadvertently create some terrible plague. And this led in 1972 and then 1973 to a series of discussions, all informal at meetings or even just over the telephone, about whether certain experiments should be done. The big change happened in 1973 when these rather cumbersome techniques suddenly became much more simple by what is now called cloning. And that, as Paul Berg, one of the organizers of the Asilomar meeting, said, that meant that anybody could now do anything. It's a bit of an exaggeration. It was still pretty complicated, but it meant that you could basically move DNA from any organism into any other. And that set off terrible alarm bells amongst the scientific community. As a result, a dozen or so leading researchers, all from the USA, signed a letter, an open letter in 1974, saying we will stop doing these experiments. We call on the scientific community to stop doing these experiments until it can be established that they can be done safely. And that was the reason why they had the Asilomar meeting in February, so about 8-9 months later, the primary aim of which was to discuss, can these experiments be done safely? Not should they be done? There's a bit of a difference, right? So there was a big technical emphasis, but still looming in the background in people's heads were the ethical issues about this is very frightening. We may inadvertently infect lab workers or even the wider community simply by shuffling around bits of DNA that have never been encountered with each other in kind of 4 billion years.
With hindsight, does the meeting merit the this sort of iconic position it has in the mythology of science in terms of scientists being responsible? Did it sort of shape the pattern of science in the following years?
Well, yes and no. As in most things, it's not quite straightforward. I mean, I think it does, you know, it deserves of huge attention. And indeed, it gets it because people are attracted, scientists in particular, are attracted by the idea of, well, we can figure this out ourselves. We're the smart people. We've got these new techniques. They're a bit flaky, but we can work it out. And, you know, this is exactly what people talk about with, say, you know, new nanotechnology or now with AI. We shouldn't actually have any regulation of this. We should allow the clever people who develop the technique to come up with the way of resolving it. So that is the discourse that is still bouncing around today. Now, on the other hand, the debates at the Asilomar did avoid the ethical issues. Some of them were simply pushed off the table. So the question of human genetic manipulation and of the creation of bioweapons were simply ruled as being not being able to be discussed. But the biosafety approaches that they developed there are still in place today, and nothing terrible has happened because these are obeyed. They are very sensible. And that enabled the rapid development of the biotech business. This is the huge explosion of venture capital getting involved in technology. And all of your listeners who use insulin, they can all be grateful for that change, because all insulin today is made by using genetically engineered microbes. And without Asilomar having laid the basis for that and said this can be done safely, then that biotech revolution would have happened much more slowly and in a very different way.
That's very interesting. I mean, because we do, it seems to be so much part of the agricultural conversation. I mean, with the 50 years of hindsight, you know, the conversation has moved on from genetic engineering to genetic editing to things like synthetic biology, artificial intelligence, and embryology. These are all sort of the modern sort of taboo topics, shall we say, where these things come up. Is the Asilomar model a good one, do you think, or could it, if it was itself modified?
Well, I think the key thing is that one of the striking things about the meeting is that although there were 16 journalists present, that was about it. There's no representative of what you might call civil society at the meeting. And understandably, given this was science in the 1970s, it was extremely dominated by the USA and by Europe. So there was no dissenting voice. In fact, the only dissenting voices really that were heard at Asilomar were those who wanted to go faster with even less regulation. I think, you know, the world's moved on, and there's being to mark the 50th anniversary, there's going to be a meeting at Asilomar next week, the end of February. And there it's going to be discussing a whole set of issues. Pathogens research, so the idea of altering viruses and so on, which has obviously caused huge speculation, most of it misplaced, about the origin of COVID-19. The danger of biological weapons, which I think we really need to say, you know, this is research that should not be done by any researcher or any country around the world, as well as about this idea of mirror biology, about creating organisms with a similar but ultimately different molecules with unknown consequences. So these are extremely alarming. And I don't think that these are things that should be decided by the scientists themselves. I do not think, and I don't think anybody at the meeting thinks, that this is simply a matter of saying, OK, well, you should do this research in a this potentially very problematic research in a particular biosecure facility and everything is going to be OK. But that is a very strong tendency within parts of the scientific community, and in particular in the USA, where there is both the idea of kind of, you know, academic freedom, I should be able to do whatever the hell I like, and also a kind of deeply ingrained cultural doubt about the role of federal restrictions. In Europe, people are a bit more relaxed about having legislation controlling whether they should or shouldn't do a particular piece of research. And I think that broader political discussion is very, very difficult, but that's what needs to take place. Scientists can come up with ideas, can make suggestions, but really these are issues that are too important to be left to the scientists, whether we should allow such research to go ahead, what's going to be the benefit, what are the risks. These are things that scientists can try and estimate, although most of them don't know much about risk-benefit analysis. And it has to be decided politically and ultimately on an international scale.
A nuanced assessment from Matthew Cobb, Emeritus Professor of Zoology at Manchester University. Further questions about equity were raised recently by ethicist Shibita Parthasarathy in an essay entitled Viewing Asilomar from the Global South.
It was a unique event at the time, and I think in memory as well. It was seen at the time as a demonstration that scientists could identify potentially risky, ethically problematic, socially problematic research early, that they were in a position to kind of make a clarion call, and that they could then organize themselves to meet, to discuss, to talk about the hard issues, and then to come to a resolution, to actually regulate themselves, essentially, to develop guidelines. What's interesting to me is that since then, there have also been so many efforts to mimic Asilomar, to mimic the magic of Asilomar, let's say.
In a sense, scientists feel it necessary to get out ahead of the criticism, to embrace the potential criticism, and I suppose frame the discussion.
Right. I mean, I would say it's not just about framing the discussion. It's also about suggesting that they can see when there's a problem, right? Look, we're responsible. Therefore, we don't need external people engaged to tell us what to do or to control us or to regulate us. We can figure out the answers ourselves.
And I suppose objectively, you know, looking back, the fact is that we've not, I don't think, had absolute horrors of genetic engineering. You know, there was a lot of Franken-scare kind of language that persisted for some decades. But in a sense, the technical aims of Asilomar were achieved.
That's true, although I'm not sure that we would have necessarily had the, you know, those kinds of Frankenstein impacts, even if there wasn't an Asilomar. I guess it's a counterfactual, it's hard to prove. But,
of course.
But it is true that, by and large, it certainly ordered the conversation. My concern about it is that it displaced some of the issues that ended up being quite serious in our conversations around biotechnology, but also more generally around science and technology. And what I think about often is that this is, you know, the 1970s is a period where there was, in parallel, a lot of other emerging concerns around science and technology, whether that was around environmental issues or women's health issues, in later years around patient advocacy groups, so AIDS activism and breast cancer activism. And in there, we're just talking about the U.S. and the Western world. And it actually created a situation where a lot of the broader concerns that were emerging, broadly speaking, about whether scientific priorities were the same as public priorities, kind of got lost in the discussion about the sort of successful Asilomar conference, which has resulted, to my mind, certainly in the United States, with somewhat of a loss of public trust that, in fact, scientists could be trusted to understand and address the real public concerns about emerging technology. So even though within the scientific community it was seen as successful, it's not totally clear to me that in the broader arena it was the kind of success that scientists continue to think that it was.
I mean, that's what seems to me very interesting about your commentary, because So the approaches and the kinds of genetic engineering one should do and the safety issues were all tackled. But in a sense, the short version, I think, of what you're saying is, whose knowledge is this?
Right. Exactly. And whose concerns matter? What kind of problem was biotechnology in the first place, or any of the other kinds of emerging technologies that have emerged since? All of these are, yes, of course, they have technical components, but at the end of the day, the question about how do we manage the risks, what are the risks of biotechnology and how do we manage them, could at least equally be seen as a social problem.
I mean, one of the things which dominated these conversations for me when I joined the BBC, long after this, but 30 years ago, I guess when genetic engineering was becoming a mature technology, was the idea that genes that existed out in the wild were suddenly being patented and taken away from indigenous populations and so on. I don't hear so much about that now, and I don't know if it's just because people have got bored of the conversation or it got solved.
For me, that is a big part of this conversation. It turns out that even at the time of Asilomar, there were concerns about the privatization of science and more generally the privatization of what people might consider to be public domain. And that was happening at the time in the 1970s, but it was excluded from the Asilomar discussion. And in almost immediately, you know, in 1980, you have the U.S. Supreme Court determining that anything under the sun made by man is patentable. And, you know, and then we're off to the genomics gold rush, we might say. And you have patents issued on genetically engineered microorganisms, as you said, on human genes, on indigenous knowledge. And that really continues. And what you've seen is that this is an issue of great concern to a variety of different citizens around the world, you know, not just in the global south, but as much in the west.
I mean, talking that way about trust is quite interesting. The conversations I would have had 20 years ago about these issues would largely have been with progressives, you might say, who are mm-hmm. talking about human rights and indigenous rights to knowledge and so on. Nowadays, there's this huge amount of distrust in the form of, let's say, vaccine hesitancy and yeah. anti-vax attitudes. Are you saying, am I pushing this too far to say that you think there's actually a thread that runs through the gaps in the Asilomar process and some of the hesitancy we see now?
I do think so. I mean, I think that, you know, science has not always been comfortable, let's say, in grappling with its corporate dimensions or its, you know, its privatization. And while it may not be self-evident always to an individual scientist in the laboratory, of course, we know that the life of the scientist has changed and the life of the university has changed. And that's not just true in the United States. It's also true, certainly, in the UK and Europe, where both scientists and universities are interested in patenting inventions that they develop. There are often technology transfer offices. There's encouragement to participate in the private sector. And often that is because that is seen as the primary way that knowledge is translated for the public interest. That's from the perspective of the scientist, of the university, and even to a degree of the government. The problem is that invariably that process does not yield benefits for publics. From their perspective, they see, certainly in the United States, high drug prices, or they see conflicts of interest that have real impacts on them. They don't trust that safety measures are serious if you know the private sector is heavily involved in shaping what those regulations are. And as a result, that does then influence vaccine hesitancy, for example. They wonder who's really making the decisions. And they see that even scientists who claim objectivity are also involved in this kind of corporate picture. And so they don't feel like they can trust scientists anymore. I mean, of course, these are complex issues. There are multiple things, I think, at stake. But I absolutely think that part of it is a reluctance to grapple with the realities of the role that the private sector plays in science.
Shubhita Parthasarathy, director of the Science, Technology and Public Policy Program at the University of Michigan. One thing that's changed since 1975 is the tone of the public conversation, with an increasing number of vocal, perhaps bad actors determined to regard science with distrust, making engagement more complex. Matthew Cobb.
Indeed. I mean, there were not bad faith, but there were good faith actors back in 1975 questioning the approach, who were from within the scientific community itself. This was a group called Science for the People. And some of the pioneers who developed some of these techniques began to become very alarmed. A man called John Beckwith in particular, who's at Harvard, who ended up saying, look, these experiments should not be done because they're too dangerous. And the Science for the People were invited to send somebody, but there were all sorts of complications. And they partly said, look, you know, we'll be the token opponent. We're not having that. And they sent an open letter to the meeting, which I think Sidney Brenner, one of the organizers, said people just put in their pockets and forgot about. So those opposing views were present. They weren't properly heard. But now we've got, as you say, bad faith actors as well. I think that becomes extremely difficult to know how to deal with this. And civil society is extremely important, but it's also about politics. And the people who are going to be implementing those regulations have to be politicians, and they need to take a responsibility. Just think about what's happening at the moment in AI. Governments are extremely excited about the possibility of AI industries in rather vague ways, but it's also their responsibility to ensure that this new technology is applied safely in exactly the same way as with the development of the railways in the 19th century, that it wasn't just a matter of having new ways of whizzing people around the world. You had to then have safe railways so that people weren't killed in railway accidents. And I think if we think of it in that way, is looking at deeper analogies in the past, you can see that politicians need to actually embrace these issues and not say, well, it's terribly complicated, I don't understand, I trust the people who are developing all this. They actually have to be involved and to help frame regulation to ensure that these technologies, if they're to be applied, can be done so for the benefit of everybody.
Matthew Cobb. If engagement with the wider public is a key to responsible science, that's what we hope to bolster here at Science in Action from the BBC World Service. Talking of which, an update on last week's item on the prospects of asteroid 2024 YR4 smacking into Earth in 2032. NASA's latest observations of the asteroid's track have shaved a few decimal points off the collision happening. The probability now stands at 1.5%. It feels a bit like reporting the day's stock markets. Anyway, I'm Roland Pease. The producer is Alex Mansfield. We're forecasting more science same time next week.